Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
This is Science in Action from the BBC. I'm John Stewart. Today, combining science and art and getting drama.
No. After all, you reach the same conclusions.
By a better route.
By a different route.
By a better route.
It's certainly simpler.
Simpler is better.
Putting the drama into discoveries. Plus, how you can help scientists figure out what whales like this one are saying. But first, climate negotiators are meeting in Durban, South Africa, for the latest round in United Nations talks. Every year, they meet to discuss progress, or otherwise, towards dealing with man-made global warming. The big divide, as always, seems to be over whether setting tight emissions targets will damage countries' economies. One of the difficulties with the science of climate change is that it is a work in progress, and new evidence is constantly coming in. Sometimes that evidence is a game changer, which means that models of global warming have to be adjusted. We've just heard about one of those, melting Arctic permafrost. That's soil that's always been frozen solid, locking away carbon. But as that permafrost melts, it will release that carbon into the atmosphere in the form of greenhouse gases, as Ted Schur from the University of Florida explains.
This is soil carbon, organic carbon, and it's the remains of plants and animals that have died thousands of years ago, and these accumulate as part of the soil. This is a natural process. But here in the north, they become trapped in permafrost, just like being in your freezer. And all of the microbial activity, bacteria and fungi that would normally break down this organic matter is slowed or almost stopped. And so this has resulted in a lot of carbon building up in these soils.
And building up and effectively being locked away. It's not sort of interacting with our atmosphere in any way.
That's right. There's a small amount that comes in each year. It also leaves by decomposition. But then there's a greater proportion that's locked away in this freezer, kind of kept there.
So as this soil does warm and some of this carbon is released, how much of a concern is that?
If there's going to be a significant release of carbon, this impacting climate, then that's a function of two things, really. It's a function of how much carbon is stored there to begin with, and then how fast can it come out if warming occurs. And what we've seen over the past few years is that there's quite a large pool of carbon there. So there's a big amount, and then what this article is attempting to uncover is what fraction of that is really vulnerable to being emitted as greenhouse gases within the next century and beyond.
So put some figures on it for us. What are we looking at?
We've known that there's this large amount of carbon there and almost twice as much carbon stored in permafrost as compared to the atmosphere. And that's gotten people quite concerned that this could come out very quickly and have a big influence on climate. By this survey, actually, we're able to put a better frame on that and say, well, we're probably not going to move all this carbon into the atmosphere within a decade or two. It's going to take a century, and we're going to lose, you know, maybe 10 to 15% of this carbon. Now, that number is smaller than the total amount, but it has a big influence. Because this carbon's coming out both as carbon dioxide and methane, both greenhouse gases, this has a chance to influence the climate on the scale of something like tropical deforestation is doing today, and even perhaps greater than that in the future.
How much of a concern is this release of carbon? How much of an influence will it have once it gets into the atmosphere?
Well, one of the main issues of the carbon release is whether it's released as carbon dioxide or as methane. So we know that these are both byproducts of bacterial decomposition, but you have methane coming from the bottom of lakes and places where oxygen is not present. And the particular concern about methane is that it has a much higher global warming potential than carbon dioxide. So it has a much stronger warming effect, about 25 times on a century timescale. Now, I think what's interesting about permafrost carbon is we find that depending on whether this soil is in an upland where it's got plenty of oxygen or if it's in a lowland, you'll find both of these gases coming out. So what we found was that of the total carbon released, only a few percent, maybe 2.5%, was expected by the experts to come out as methane. But because it has this high warming potential, about half of the potential climate effect is coming from methane. So what that tells us is that both methane and carbon dioxide together are going to be very important in shifting the future climate based on the releases that are coming out of the soil.
So is there anything that we can do about it?
So we're not going to likely go to the Arctic and try to control emissions directly at the source, but we can reduce the overall emissions by focusing on those under human control. So the lower the overall temperature rise that we have in the future, the more of that permafrost carbon will stay frozen where it is now.
And according to Ted Scher there, we could end up with a vicious circle if it doesn't stay frozen, because the warmer it gets, the more the permafrost melts, releasing more greenhouse gases and therefore warming the climate even more. That research has just been published in the journal Nature. You're with Science in Action from the BBC. Next, a subject that's a favourite of ours, the intersection of science and art. STAGE, which stands for Scientists, Technologists and Artists Generating Exploration, is awarding $10,000 for a new play about science or technology. This will be the fifth time that the prize has been awarded, and the current STAGE winner is Craig Baxter, a playwright from Cambridge in the UK, who also works for the International Glaciological Society. And we asked him to describe his winning entry.
It's a play called The Altruists, and it's based on, three very significant evolutionary biologists working in London in the late 1960s, early 1970s. The main character is George Price, who's an American scientist who came over, and he linked up with Bill Hamilton and John Maynard Smith and did lots of the work that lies behind selfish gene theory.
Thank you so much for sending me your paper.
Happy to oblige. I'm grateful to find anyone who appreciates, well, anyone who's read my work.
Yeah, well, the mathematics in it was rather formidable to absorb in the library with all the distractions. I needed my own copy. I have it here.
My strategy has always been to intimidate the reader with some equations so that they'll take the verbal arguments more seriously. I miscalculated with this one.
Yeah, you did.
I mean, I get the impression that, apart from you, nobody's got past the equations. The world has remained seriously underwhelmed by my big idea.
It's really just a kind of economic cost-benefit optimization analysis. The cost of an altruistic act being balanced by the benefits accrued by blood relatives of the altruist?
More or less.
I find it profoundly shocking.
My paper?
You didn't mind my rederiving your equations?
That's why I wanted to talk to you face to face.
You do mind?
No. After all, you reach the same conclusions.
By a better route.
By a different route.
By a better route.
It's certainly simpler.
Simpler is better.
But you don't even refer to kin selection in your formulations or in your notes. Kin selection is what my paper is actually about.
My formulation applies to more than just kin selection. It's applicable to any kind of selection, even group selection.
Oh, no. My whole theory is an alternative to group selection, which is inviolable as a theory, being so woolly, so ill-defined, and so generally powerless against selection at the individual and genic levels as to be practically useless.
There is a group of individuals in which a gene that codes for behavior is at a particular frequency. After the behavior has been expressed, the frequency of the gene within the group will have changed, and the size of the group will have changed also. If the behavior is altruistic, then the gene will decline in frequency within the group, but will increase the size of the group. So if there are numerous groups, you can expect a positive correlation between the frequency of altruists and the benefit of the group. Your idea is profound. I mean that seriously. It's depressingly profound that there is no group ethos, that we are not even individuals on a mission staying alive, having kids, but some hideous infighting committee of power-crazed genes and factions of genes, an uneasy alliance struggling for survival.
That depresses you? It excites me.
You have changed the perspective. It's like Copernicus moving the center of the universe. It's not about us anymore, let alone anything higher than us. No one knows who I am. I don't know who I am. Not one of the genes that created me knows who I am or cares.
I didn't mean it personally.
And that nepotistic, selfish altruism of one identical gene to another is the best, the most humane type of goodness that evolution can achieve. We're not even alone. We're less than alone.
Adam Billington and Christopher Webster there in a special recording of an extract from The Altruist for Science in Action. A very tense moment in evolutionary biology. But how hard is it getting science into drama? Craig Baxter again.
Well, I suppose it's trying to find some resonance with what's happening in their lives as well. So I think this subject lends itself to that in that it's, although the science is about altruism and is quite technical and difficult in a way, it has a thematic resonance with what's happening in their lives. And, other successful science plays like Copenhagen by Michael Frayn, you've got the science is all about uncertainty. And the dramatic centre of that is about an uncertainty about what happened, what was said at a particular meeting. And so it's finding a scientific subject that matches the dramatic subject.
So that's an interesting side of it that perhaps we don't see as often, because by the time science is presented to we the public, it tends to be something that's published and peer-reviewed and is presented almost as fact. But you're sort of getting at the process behind that and the inherent drama in it.
Yes, I mean, it's more about the characters and the personality. I mean, drama is really about behaviour and what people do to each other and do to themselves. The scientific content of plays about scientists is very important, but it's the first thing to get jettisoned in a way, particularly if the play is adapted for a film or something, and kind of there's hardly any of the science left. You think you forget the feeling by the time it's hit the silver screen. But with a play, you've got a bit more opportunity for ideas to be bounced around that are of a more technical nature, and that's fun as long as but you have to find ways of making it fun, entertaining, get some jokes in, get some misunderstandings, get some conflict in, people disagreeing with each other is always, you know, dramatic. If everyone is just spouting the scientific consensus, that's not so interesting. But you have here, I mean, my play deals with the time when the subject is very much in a state of flux, and it's also the scientists George Price and Bill Hamilton particularly are sort of outsider figures. Their work is not generally understood or fashionable at the time, and they have to fight to get their papers published, and that's a battle in itself, and that's what you need in a drama to some extent.
Previous winner Craig Baxter. Well, Nancy Kowalek is from Stage, the competition organizers.
We're living in this extremely technological and scientifically oriented world, but there's very little theater that I see that reflects the world in which we live. So that was one main goal behind setting up the competition. The other was to make science much more accessible and understandable to the public.
Why do you think science isn't reflected very well?
I think scientists are wonderful at what they do, but they often are not able to explain to the public at large the kind of work that they're doing. So I think they're actually very responsive when I talk to them about the competition, because they're delighted that somebody wants to make their work accessible. We've had entrants from very established, prominent playwrights and screenwriters. In the past, we had an unknown playwright living in a remote part of Nigeria send us a script. We get scripts from highly regarded scientists. We've even had an entry from a Nobel laureate in the past. And so far this year, we've received scripts from all over the United States, of course, and New Zealand and the Philippines, Canada, Wales, England, the Netherlands. We received an entry from Russia this year. That was our first from Russia.
So there really are plenty of people out there who are willing to try to tackle this pretty difficult sort of meeting of science and art.
Yes, and it is very difficult to artfully incorporate science into a script, but some people manage to do it very, very well.
Nancy Kowalek, and we'll be checking back in as the judges draw up a short list of entries. There are more details on our website and on my Facebook page, which is John Stewart BBC. And while you're there, there's also a link to a site that has captivated us, where you can help scientists trying to figure out what whales are saying to each other. Marine scientists have long been trying to decode whale song. Many suspect that the sometimes haunting, sometimes chaotic calls may betray a complex language. Well, now researchers are asking us for a hand in identifying whale dialects. Ian Boyd is the director of the Sea Mammal Research Institute at St Andrews University in Scotland.
These animals have hugely variable vocal repertoires. It's listening to them for a long period of time leaves you thinking that they've got some form of vocal gymnastics going on. It's absolutely incredible how variable their calls are. It's probably much more variable than us, and what they can actually do with sound is quite remarkable.
Just give us an idea of some of the ways that whales sort of communicate.
There are a number of different types of calls that we recognise. There are sort of long squeaks with maybe up sweeps. And we also find calls that also have down sweeps. So they start high and finish low. And there are also clicks. And we also hear things called buzzies. The buzzies are probably not to do with communication. They're more to do with hunting and trying to zero in on a prey item or something like that.
And where do all these recordings come from?
Well, the recordings are made by researchers who are studying these animals mainly at the surface, actually. But of course, a lot of these animals spend most of their lives below the surface. And one of the ways that we study them is to drop a hydrophone, which is just a microphone, but it can be submerged in water, into the water while these animals are around. And sometimes you can pick up some very high quality recordings as a result of that.
And then these are what is up on your website, and you're asking people to go and have a listen and try to identify them. What's the idea behind that?
If you go into the website, you get presented with a call. Now, it's presented in a visual form, which we call a spectrogram, and it's just a way of visualizing the pattern of sound. But you can actually click on it, and you can hear the sound. Having done that, the program then selects from over 15,000 calls that we have within the database, calls that it thinks might be similar, and then it asks you to click on the one that you think is most similar to the call you've just looked at and listened to.
So why can't you just get a computer to do this matching? Why are you asking people to help you?
Well, actually, computers are really not very good at this. The human brain and the human eye is extraordinarily good at picking out patterns in things. For example, if a call just varies very slightly or a little bit of it is missing, the human brain will fill in the gaps, whereas a computer can't do that. And as a result, you get much better results out of it. But the other side of this is that we want to engage with very large numbers of people because we've got very large numbers of calls, and the work with an individual human operator trying to do this on their own, or even a small group of operators trying to do it, would be absolutely enormous.
And when you have all this information and you have these calls and hopefully got some good matches, what's kind of the key question that you want to be able to answer?
To my mind, the key question is, do the call structures have some internal structural elements to them that suggest that there's the complexity sitting in there of language? Now, we don't know that, but it's quite possible that because of the huge variety of sounds these animals are being able to produce, that if they produce them in certain patterns and with certain associations, then we can relate those patterns and associations with what we traditionally call language. And we can perhaps try to make a step forward with respect to understanding whether these animals are actually communicating in a very simple way, as most animals do, or in a very complex way, as very few animals do, including us.
Ian Boyd. So if you think you're the next whale whisperer, you can go online and give it a go. Science in Action was produced by Anya Liktorovich and Jennifer Carpenter, and our coverage continues at bbcworldservice.com.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.